Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Craig Aaron of Free Press, who connects the dots between the recent political censorship of the CBS News program 60 Minutes and the threat posed to press freedom by the consolidation of media ownership. Parker Malloy, a media critic and cultural commentator, who talks about the harm that will be caused by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s nationwide ban on doctor-provided gender-affirming care to trans youth. And Meg Youssef, mobilization coordinator with Labor Force, who explains how her group is building a stronger labor union movement across the U.S. through public advocacy. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
If, as expected, the right-wing majority of U.S. Supreme Court justices weaken or eliminate a key provision of the 1965 Voting Rights Act in June, Republicans could gain nearly 200 state legislative seats in 10 GOP-controlled state legislatures across the South. According to a study by Fair Fight Action, a Supreme Court decision in the Louisiana versus Calais case abolishing Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act would allow Republican-majority states to redraw district maps that would likely eliminate dozens of majority Black and Latino districts. While concentrated in the South, the ruling could affect minority representation across the country in both state and federal legislatures, potentially returning to pre-1965 conditions where minority voters lacked meaningful representation and leading to a new extreme level of voter suppression. Civil rights and progressive activists have warned that up to 27 congressional districts could suffer a significant loss of Black and Hispanic office holders. Western oil companies, including Chevron and ExxonMobil, are considering investing billions of dollars in Libya's lucrative energy sector. But ongoing instability after the nation's 15-year-long civil war has resulted in massive corruption and theft of oil revenues. The Sentry, an investigative organization that seeks to disable multinational predatory networks, found that by 2024, almost $7 billion in subsidized fuel, about 15% of total public spending, was stolen annually. This multi-billion dollar theft was supported by Russia, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates. As a result, Libyan citizens must often pay up to 40 times the official subsidized price for fuel, while many of their leaders get rich from illegal sales of oil to neighboring countries. After Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown and killed by rebels supported by NATO airstrikes in 2011, the country has been divided by rival governments in Tripoli and Benghazi that both receive a cut of the illegal oil profits. In a commentary, the Sentry warns that unless Washington and its allies negotiate with Libya's civilian institutions rather than its ruling kleptocratic families, corruption will continue hurting the Libyan people, increasing the likelihood of renewed violence and political disruption harming everyone, including international investors. In a policy initiative never seen before in U.S. history, President Donald Trump has ordered National Guard troops deployed to major U.S. cities, including Los Angeles, Memphis, Washington, D.C., New Orleans, Portland, and Chicago, for what he claims is a mission to fight urban crime. Although the U.S. Supreme Court recently temporarily blocked the National Guard deployment to Chicago, the Trump regime is expected to continue their effort to militarize U.S. cities. As elected officials around the country publicly opposed militarizing their cities, Detroit leaders gathered in October to underscore their success in dramatically decreasing violent crime there. Detroit's homicide rate has dropped nearly 40% over the last decade, the lowest number recorded since 1965. Yet, since April, the Trump regime has systematically defunded Detroit's and other cities' successful community violence intervention programs. In July, the administration cut $158 million in grants for gun violence prevention programs around the nation, including $10 million for Detroit initiatives. In October, however, the Michigan State Legislature approved $95 million in public safety funding for the state's municipalities. Detroit will use the funds to boost their community violence intervention teams. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As Donald Trump ends his first year of his second term back in the White House, the twice-impeached convicted felon has made attacks on the media a central focus of his administration. The president has relentlessly launched verbal assaults, lawsuits, and threats to revoke the broadcast licenses of media outlets that carry commentary or other programming critical of Mr. Trump's administration. Regrettably, these intimidation tactics have often succeeded in causing some of the nation's most powerful media companies to surrender to Trump by paying out millions of dollars in settlements in frivolous lawsuits, or the cancellation of CBS late-night TV host Stephen Colbert and the temporary suspension of ABC host Jimmy Kimmel until a major public backlash erupted. But after the decision by CBS News editor-in-chief Barry Weiss to cancel a December 21st 60 Minutes story critical of the Trump regime's deportation of immigrants abducted in the U.S. to El Salvador's brutal CICOT prison, it's clear that media mergers now pose a dire threat to U.S. press freedom. In August, CBS News parent company Paramount was taken over by David Ellison and his father, tech billionaire Larry Ellison, a staunch Trump ally, who installed Barry Weiss at CBS to pursue an anti-woke agenda in the news division. Media mergers involving broadcast licenses, which require FCC approval, strengthens the ability of Donald Trump to influence and potentially censor the content of media companies vulnerable to political and regulatory pressure. Your reporter spoke with Craig Aaron, co-CEO of the media democracy group Free Press, who connects the dots between censorship at CBS News and media oligarchs currying favor with Trump to gain federal approval for lucrative mega media mergers.
The thing about 60 Minutes is a lot of people still watch 60 Minutes, right? Huge audience. And to have a national in-depth television program talking about the kidnapping of innocent folks, the sending of them to an incredibly abusive prison in El Salvador. These were men, most of them from Venezuela. And the story, which you can find online, fortunately, details just the horrific abuses faced by these men who were sent there, you know, by the Trump administration. And even, of course, when it was revealed that the wrong people were sent, innocent people were sent, there was no due process, a very important story that needs to get out there. From the media perspective, though, why this story stands out is the fact that CBS, at the very last minute, decided not to run it, and their newly appointed editor-in-chief, Barry Weiss, the one associated with that other Free Press, made a very public show of yanking this story at the last minute and claiming it lacked balance and it lacked an administration perspective, when, of course, the reporters working on this story had tried to get a response from the government about what they were doing and were stonewalled and not gotten back to. And so this was a story that had already gone through all the standards and practices, all the lawyers, all the producers, only to be yanked by this newly appointed editor-in-chief who was put in there to essentially police the newsroom for signs of wokeness, you know, supposed imbalance that might go against the Trump regime. And the backdrop of all of this is promises made by the leadership of CBS, now owned by a company called Paramount Skydance, in order to complete that merger, the selling of CBS, the selling of Paramount to Skydance, a company controlled by the Ellison family, Larry Ellison, one of the richest men in the world, the owner of Oracle, and his son, David Ellison, who's been put in charge of the media empire. They've made a lot of promises to the Trump administration that they're going to change the way the news is done, by which they appear to mean we're going to try to make it more favorable to the Trump administration. So Trump has complained about a lot about the coverage on CBS. Here comes Barry Weiss. Here comes David Ellison yanking this incredibly important story and directly interfering in the newsroom, which is the thing that people had really feared the most. We've seen, you know, a whole series of bad actions, you know, including the firing of Stephen Colbert, the ridiculous settling of a lawsuit over the editing of an interview with the former vice president, Kamala Harris. And now we see this direct interference in independent journalism and in a program that, whatever its strengths or flaws, had been long left alone by management to do its reporting. And of course, had done a number of very important stories over the years. This one, you know, another very important story that now may never be seen because Barry Weiss decided to spike it to please Donald Trump and J.D. Vance and Stephen Miller and all the rest.
Craig, as you mentioned, there's been a slew of recent media mergers that have enabled billionaires and oligarchs who are allies of Donald Trump to control key media outlets that have enormous potential to shape public opinion, both political and cultural. We've had mergers that have included TikTok, CBS, Paramount, as we've been talking about, Warner Brothers Discovery. Netflix, of course, is involved in bidding on that. And CNN could be affected by whatever comes out with the bid for Warner Brothers Discovery.
That's right.
It's a whole alphabet soup of different companies, and I know it can be confusing. Break it down for us. What's going on in terms of the shakeout of the media industry in the U.S. right now?
Well, what you're seeing is, as you described it, Scott, some of the richest people in the world who are closest to Donald Trump and want the Trump administration to do his bidding, trying to set themselves up to control so much of what you watch, see, hear, and read every day. And this is a playbook that goes back to our old friend Elon Musk, who spent a big chunk of his immense fortune to buy what used to be called Twitter, now X, showed kind of, hey, if you're in charge, you can twist it and bend it to be about what you want it to be about. And the other billionaires were very much paying attention. And so we listed a ton of deals there, but the name that's connected to almost all of them is Ellison. So Larry Ellison, one of the five or six richest men in the world, his son David Ellison, who wants to be the next Rupert Murdoch, they've been moving very aggressively in the Trump administration to consolidate, to sweep up more media, and really putting a lot of pressure on the various newsrooms and companies they work for to get in line to get these deals done. The takeover of Paramount was the first big one to fall. You saw the company settle an absolutely specious lawsuit to get that deal done. You saw the installation of Barry Weiss. You saw the installation of a bias monitor to watch out for supposed bias against conservatives, all to please the administration and try to grease the wheels so that they can get more media properties.
That was Craig Aaron, co-CEO of Free Press and Free Press Action. Learn more about the threat to press freedom posed by the consolidation of media ownership by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. President Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and Dr. Mehmet Oz, administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, announced at a December 18th press conference proposed new regulations that would essentially impose a nationwide ban on gender-affirming care for transgender young people, even in states where it's still legal. One of the measures would prohibit hospitals that provide gender-affirming care to youth under the age of 18 from receiving Medicaid and Medicare funds. In June, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for youth, and about half of U.S. states now ban medication and surgery for transgender youth treatment. While Kennedy claimed gender-affirming care has inflicted lasting physical and psychological damage on vulnerable young people, the American Academy of Pediatrics responded by declaring these proposed restrictions are a baseless intrusion into the patient-physician relationship. A coalition of 19 Democratic-led states in Washington, D.C., filed a lawsuit against the Federal Health Agency, arguing that RFK Jr.'s anti-trans regulations are unlawful and a government overreach. Your reporter spoke with Parker Malloy, a media critic, cultural commentator, and publisher of the Present Age Substack newsletter. Here, Malloy, a trans person herself, talks about the harm these new restrictions will cause and the culture war political weaponization of trans issues employed by Donald Trump and the Republican Party.
It's important to understand where the federal government is coming from on this. You know, and when they talk about adverse outcomes and things like that, they basically mean you might end up being trans. You know, if you want to understand where it's going, listen to, you know, what they actually said at that press conference. You had HHS Deputy Secretary Jim O'Neill up there saying men are men. Men can never become women. Women are women. Women can never become men. At the root of the evils we face, such as the blurring of the lines between sexes and radical social agendas, is a hatred for nature as God designed it. You know, he's not talking about children there. He's talking about the existence of trans people, period. You know, and that's the foundation of the worldview. Trans people don't exist. There's no good faith debate happening here about what the protocol should be or whether the care works. They've rejected the premise entirely. They don't believe that there are people for whom this care could possibly be beneficial because they don't believe trans people are real. So when people ask, will they come for adults next? You know, that's something that comes up a lot. The answer is that they already are. The reconciliation bill earlier this year included language banning Medicaid coverage of gender-affirming care for adults, not just minors. It got stripped out, but they keep trying. As it concerns what gender-affirming care means, you know, people think surgery. Surgery is extraordinarily rare and would only be for, you know, late teens, people in their late teens. What this would prevent, this rule, would prevent hospitals and other affected providers from being able to prescribe hormones, which older teens can start hormone replacement therapy. And for younger teens, you know, there's puberty blockers, and those would also become impossible to prescribe anymore. And, you know, what's really kind of frustrating about all of this and how this has gone is that Republicans have spent years talking about parental rights. Parents should decide what books their kids read. Parents should control what their kids learn in school. But when parents working with their kids and their doctors decide that gender-affirming care is appropriate, they want to send the government in to step in. Suddenly the parents should face prison time.
Parker, I wanted to ask you, why do you think this trans issue that's been weaponized by Republicans and conservatives in recent elections, why has it been so effective? I was astonished to learn that in the closing days of the 2024 presidential election, most of the funds of the Trump campaign were dedicated to anti-trans ads on TV. When I heard that, I said, who's the audience for this? I mean, do they think that's the number one issue for Americans?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a successful wedge for them to get their base riled up, to sow doubt, you know, among voters. It's not trans people talking. It's all of these politicians and, you know, people in media who are really pushing a very anti-trans point of view. Democrats were not out there talking about trans people nonstop in the 2024 campaign. That just didn't happen. They didn't spend any money on pro-trans ads. But when you talk to people, there's this idea that Democrats care too much about trans people, that Democrats won't stop talking about it. But really, they're not talking at all. That's why I think the right has been able to use this as an issue, because Democrats have kind of shied away from this issue to where they won't defend the positions that they supposedly have. Like, for instance, what Kamala Harris said in that clip that went viral about people in prison having access to health care, that's just the Eighth Amendment. People in prison, you know, were required to give them health care. That's how it works. It's not actually a radical thing to argue, but it was weaponized. And rather than just say, this is a constitutional issue, you know, instead, Democrats kind of danced around it and didn't push back, which right. I think made them seem untrustworthy on the topic. And I think that may have driven some voters to the right.
That was Parker Malloy, publisher of the Present Age Substack newsletter. Find links to Malloy's recent commentaries and related news and analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. We're living in a time of growing public support for unions and simultaneously a hostile environment toward labor promoted by corporations and oligarchs allied with Donald Trump and the Republican Party. The current situation is illustrated by workers at Starbucks and Amazon who've successfully voted in unions, but the bosses refuse to negotiate. And under the Trump regime, unionized workers can't expect any help from the majority of the president's appointees on the National Labor Relations Board. Enter the Labor Force, an independent organization founded on Labor Day 2024 to provide online support and digital outreach to workers organizing and fighting for decent contracts. With a staff of just four, plus some consultants, the group has succeeded in raising the profile of many union struggles over the past year. Labor Force supports union workers with innovative strategies at coffee shops, grocery stores, the federal government, and more. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Meg Yosef, mobilization coordinator with the Labor Force, who explains how the group is building a stronger labor movement through public advocacy.
We realize that only about 10% of workers in the U.S. are organized, but the public support for unions is massive. So like about 60 or 70% of the public is excited about unions and supports unions. So like, how can we get the public involved and build a stronger labor movement when there's that much support, but so many obstacles to workers actually organizing and forming a union in their own workplace? So like a union comes to us or we find a union and they're like, hey, we have needs. We have stuff going on. Can you support us? And we kind of form deep relationships with those groups, understand what their needs are, their organizing needs, their technological needs, fundraising, what's going on in their campaigns, and find places where we can both help them behind the scenes with like technological and strategic support, but also bring them into our public advocacy program and get the public involved in their campaigns. So that could look like the example of Blue Bottle. They went on strike last month. They had a successful 4-day strike at all locations, and our community donated to their strike fund so that baristas could stay on the picket lines and still pay their rent and buy groceries. During the course of their campaign, our community has, you know, called managers to say, hey, you got to reinstate this worker you fired. You know, bargain with your workers. We've sent letters. So there's a lot of digital actions our community takes, donations that our community makes. And also more and more, we are focused as our community grows on connecting folks to in-person events too. So going to the picket lines, doing leafleting events, you know, getting out and about in the community.
Where do you get your funding?
One of the beautiful and tough things about it is that a lot of our funding comes from other working class people who see the fight as their fight, who make donations. And so a significant amount comes from regular folks making small donations, which has been absolutely unbelievable. Just in October, we were able to raise and redistribute almost $500,000 in funds during the government shutdown when federal workers were like, all right, we're not getting paid. How are we going to eat through this government shutdown? It's going on. And there was just a lot of people were in crisis. And so we were like, let's see if we can raise money just to get grocery gift cards to these workers. And that was really just mutual aid, working class people helping other working class people.
It's not unions per se that are part of the labor force. Is that correct?
There aren't any unions that are part, quote unquote, part of the labor force. It's more that we partner with unions to help uplift their needs. But we really intentionally created ourselves as an independent organization so we can help all workers.
What unions have you been supporting?
We've worked with AFGE and federal workers. We've worked with SEIU over the summer. One of their leaders in California was detained by ICE. And so very quickly, members of our community attended and hosted rallies to demand his release. We've also done campaigns where we've gone out to, our members have gone out to Home Depot parking lots to share Know Your Rights information with other customers there. So we really work with both large established unions, small independent unions, groups that may not be formally unionized through NLRB elections, but are still organizing in their workplace. So we're really there for all kinds of workers that are organizing, whatever their model is that works for them.
When I first learned about you, you had mentioned something about lifting up Starbucks workers on strike.
The Starbucks workers have been on strike since November 13th. And so it's now, you know, been over a month of that union's longest work stoppage yet. And it's still going on.
And how many stores?
The way that Starbucks Workers United has been doing their strike, it's kind of going in waves. So like every week or so, like more stores are going on strike. And I think right now it is about 3,800 baristas at 180 cafes across 130 cities. So it's expanded pretty far. The first Starbucks was unionized in just 4 years ago, and there are now, I think, about 550 unionized locations with about 11 or 12,000 unionized baristas. So it's a really significant movement. And I think that when those workers win a contract, it's going to be really impactful for the service industry as a whole. For your audience who's listening, the main thing that they can do right now is just don't buy Starbucks. Don't buy coffee. Don't buy beans. Don't get Starbucks gift cards for presents during the holidays. Like, don't cross the picket line. Support baristas by not buying Starbucks.
That was Meg Yosef, mobilization coordinator with the labor force. Learn more about how labor force supports America's unions by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WAAA in Epsom, New Hampshire, WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, KFUG in Crescent City, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For myself, Scott Harris, and all of us at Between the Lines, we wish you, our listeners, a new year filled with more light than darkness.